Welcome to this episode of Sisters Sidebar with Barb McQuaid and me, Kim Atkinstor. So we love answering your questions, and that's why we love when you send them in. Keep them coming. You know what to do. You can send them to sistersinlaw@politicon.com. In an email, you can either type out your question, but we love even more when you put it in a voice note. That way we can hear your voice and we can perhaps play your voice on a future episode. You can also get in our socials by using hashtag sistersinlaw as usual and send your questions there as well. So let's get started. Barb, the first question is for you and it comes from Tracy.
Good day, sisters. This is Tracy from Upper Marlboro, Maryland. I'm hoping that I can have you answer a question that takes you a little bit off your normal beaten path. I am a career human resources professional, been in the field for 38 years, and my question to you is this. With the Trump administration making changes to the EEOC and the NLRB, what are the chances that a person of color or someone over 40 or someone from another country will have a valid EEOC investigation conducted should they submit a credible claim of discrimination? And on the union side, what are the chances that a union grievance that gets up to the NLRB level is going to be properly adjudicated and fairly adjudicated in that process? Thank you. And I love you, ladies. I learned so much about the law from you. So I appreciate what you're doing. Keep it up.
Yeah, thanks, Tracy. I hear you. That's such a great question. You know, the EEOC is really out of whack. For one thing, rather than looking for claims of discrimination, as we've traditionally thought of them in the workplace, Trump has suggested that the EEOC really ought to be looking at diversity, equity, and inclusion programs and trying to unearth those kinds of things. The other thing that he's done is remove commissioners who were appointed by Democratic presidents such that it no longer has a quorum. And so that really frustrates the ability to do anything there. I think what a claimant probably needs to do is file a claim with the EEOC because there is an exhaustion of administrative remedies requirement. But I think once they sit on it for, 30 days, whatever, because there is no quorum, I think at that point, a litigant could go to court and say, I have effectively exhausted my remedies because the EEOC is not acting on my claim. Therefore, my next step is to come to district court. And frankly, it's kind of a good result, right? Because the EEOC would just delay and tie things up and probably not grant relief to a true case of discrimination. So now, in effect, you get to go directly to court. So maybe in some ways, we're just able to bypass Trump's EEOC where there's a thumb on the scale. All right, Kim, here's one for you. This comes from Arthur in San Francisco, California. Arthur asks, how does the SCOTUS emergency docket differ from their usual cases?
Oh, this is a really good question, Arthur. We talk a lot about the shadow docket, but I don't think we always fully explain how that is different from what I call the merits docket on the court. So typically on the merits docket, what happens is a party petitions the court to take up an issue, a challenge, an appeal to a case that is ongoing or that has concluded. And the Supreme Court, if they decide to take it up, what they do is they set a schedule for the parties to submit full briefings of the issues involved in it. They invite friends of the court to also submit briefs if they have a stake in the case. And then they set oral arguments in the case at some point. They hear oral arguments. And then after the arguments, the justices get together and they deliberate and they come to a vote as to how the case comes out, right? So there is an opportunity for everyone to be heard in that case. The emergency docket, which we sometimes refer to as the shadow docket, is very different. What that traditionally has been for are for interim orders that the court needs to decide some issue when there is some ongoing litigation. So a good example is the ballroom litigation, right? The National Trust is suing to halt construction of the White House ballroom. But there was a question as to whether the White House needed to stop construction while that challenge played out. So they went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has asked for more time to decide whether the construction has to stop while this challenge goes on or if it can continue. But that's the Supreme Court's not deciding the ultimate issue. It's meant to be done quickly. Well, the problem is, and the reason it's gotten the name the shadow docket, is increasingly rulings on the emergency docket are being made in a way that actually effectively amount to a final decision in the case. But it still does not have the full briefing. There are no oral arguments. There is not the public transparency that you would have in a different case. And a good example of that is before the Dobbs decision, there was a ruling in which the court basically allowed a similar all but abortion ban in Louisiana to take effect without argument, without full briefing and all of that. And that sort of was like, wait a minute, that's substantive law. The Supreme Court just allowed a law to take effect that clearly violates Roe. That's, in my opinion, an impermissible use of the emergency docket to actually make law. It was just a matter of months later that the Supreme Court handed down Dobbs anyway, but that's how we knew that what they were going to do. So that's the difference between the two. So there's a question for you, Barb. It comes from Bernie in Australia, who asks, what's the difference between selective prosecution and prosecutorial discretion?
Oh, thank you, Bernie. This is something that I teach in my criminal procedure class. So ordinarily, prosecutors are given a great deal of discretion. The reason is you can't possibly prosecute every single violation of the law, nor would you want to. You try to find things that actually have a harmful impact on public safety, or where you want to have a deterrent effect, or there's a rehabilitation goal. All of those things. And in fact, federal prosecutors have something called the principles of federal prosecution, which gives prosecutors a number of factors to consider that would favor prosecution and others that would disfavor it. Like even collateral consequences. If you're going to charge a hospital with a crime, might it put the hospital out of business? And what impact would that have on community members who rely on that hospital for their health care? So all of these sort of appropriate factors for prosecutors to consider in whether to bring a case or not bring a case. That's prosecutorial discretion. And our separation of powers grants prosecutors that power to decide which cases to prosecute. However, selective prosecution occurs when they violate one of those prohibited reasons for exercising their discretion. And that is, you can't go after somebody on an arbitrary basis when others who are similarly situated are not being prosecuted. That's considered a violation of the Fifth Amendment right to due process. So a place where this has come up, and I think where there's actually a pretty decent claim, is Jim Comey in the Seychelles case. What he has said is, this is not really an appropriate law enforcement objective. There's no basis for thinking that I'm really dangerous or a threat to the public or any other thing. And in fact, there are many other people similarly situated. And just looking on Amazon, you can find hundreds of thousands of them, of people have posted this 8647 message. And so what it seems like is you are just using, you're singling me out for punishment for a crime that otherwise goes unpunished. So that's selective prosecution. Pretty rare to show it because of this great respect we have for prosecutorial discretion. But I think in Comey's case, he's got a pretty good argument. The internet is still the Wild West, and it's full of stalkers, scammers, and hackers. You know you should protect yourself, but how? It's easier than you think. Here's what you do. Go to www.joindeleteme.com/sisters and enter code SISTERS to get 20% off Delete Me.
Delete Me removes your personal information that's being sold online, which is why you really need to get it. In the age of AI, we all are especially vulnerable to scammers using your personal data that's floating around on the internet against you. Have you ever Googled yourself and found your home address or phone number or the name of a family member? It's really unsettling, and there's a lot worse out there. The good news is Delete Me can help.
Delete Me does all the hard work to wipe your personal information from data broker websites. and you can get an individual plan for a little more than $8 per month. Even if you're not a public figure, in the internet age, all of us are potential targets for malicious actors or blackmailers and worse. Especially if you have kids in your family, Delete Me is a must. Once we got started with them, the peace of mind was such a relief. I trust them to protect me, my sisters, and my loved ones. And I know that they can help keep you and your family safe too.
Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. Now, at a special discount for our listeners, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/sisters and use promo code SISTERS at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to www.joindeleteme.com/sisters and enter code SISTERS at checkout. That's www.joindeleteme.com/sisters, code SISTERS, and the link is in our show notes.
When you're busy, fitting in an effective workout can be a challenge. You want something that does more than burn calories. You want muscular strength, better balance, and something that doesn't take hours. That's where LifePro Waiver Vibration Plate comes in. At first, you might think there's no way that only 10 minutes on one would feel like an effective workout, but you would be wrong. 10 minutes on the LifePro Waiver burns about 50 to 100 calories, depending on your body weight and what exercises you're doing. It's like a 15-minute walk in a fraction of the time with basically zero joint impact. Not only does it work, but after you might lie on it for a massage, I don't know, after exercising, you'll know that it's going to be a key component of your fitness plan. You might become hooked.
These days, bad posture and muscle tightness are almost universal. We need to move. And when you stand on the waiver, your muscles are constantly firing to stabilize your body. Your nervous system literally can't ignore the vibration. So your muscles keep automatically contracting the entire time. After a session, you feel much looser and relaxed. And if you're feeling lazy, you can literally stand on it, sit on it, or use it at your desk while you're working.
That could be tricky, though. You might start humming in a funny way. No matter what, your muscles will still be activating the entire time, so your core is getting stronger just standing there. It's an easy way to get your body moving and kickstart your metabolism without carving out a full workout. And there's nothing better to get your system moving in the mornings. Now you'll feel so much more mobile, energized, and recovered that you'll want to make it part of your routine. The vibration amplifies every exercise you're already doing, engaging more muscle fibers and forcing better neuromuscular activation. And if you're feeling like pushing yourself, you can use the resistance bands for squats or calf raises or planks to really feel the burn.
A lot of cheaper vibration plates online look flimsy and gimmicky, but the waiver is stable, powerful, and premium. Some of the higher settings are seriously crazy, so it's no surprise that LifePro is America's number one vibration plate brand and has over 2.5 million users. They even offer a lifetime warranty and risk-free 30-day returns, so you know they stand behind their product. And for a limited time, our listeners can get $20 off the Waiver Vibration Plate plus free shipping with code SISTERS at lifeprofitness.com. That's lifeprofitness.com and use code SISTERS for $20 off. After you purchase, they'll ask where you heard about them. Please support our show by telling them that we sent you. The link is in our show notes.
Our next question comes to us from Amanda. Let's listen to Amanda's question.
Hi, sisters. It's Amanda from Tennessee. My sister asked me if it was a crime to conceal Mitch McConnell's death, so I figured I would ask you. Thanks.
Oh, Amanda, that is a good question. So, you know, you and your sister ask an interesting question. So, no, there is not, to my knowledge, a federal law that requires the public disclosure when a member of Congress has died, and therefore there cannot be any criminal liability for not disclosing if a member of Congress has died. Of course, this refers to the fact that Senator McConnell has not been seen or heard from, except for that one hostage video, that one picture from his purportedly from his hospital room with his wife. I have no reason to believe he has left this dimension, but it is concerning that he has been just sort of unavailable for so long and very little information has been given. I think that's bad for public trust, which is exactly why you're asking this question. The only way that I could think of to think that this could raise to the level of a crime is, say, if, for example, this expired after the pandemic, but for a while there were proxy voting rules. If someone pretended to submit a proxy vote on his behalf or something, that could be interfering with an official proceeding or doing so fraudulently. That could be against the law. If someone knew that he had passed away and made a false statement about him being alive in a government proceeding, perhaps that could be seen as something. But generally speaking, there is no duty to disclose when someone dies, and so therefore no liability that can be had if someone does and that is not disclosed.
We still haven't seen him, right? I mean, you were talking about the social media the picture of Elaine Chao. Have you seen the meme where Elaine Chao is posing with Mitch McConnell in his hospital bed, and then after a period of time, she folds him up because he's a cardboard cutout? Clearly AI generated, but pretty funny.
Yeah, we don't know. We don't know where Mitch is. So maybe one day we'll find out. Our next question comes from J. Gatti Petito, forgive me if I say that wrong, who asks, could the special grand jury being convened in D.C. have something to do with the contempt charges against either Anthony Fauci or Jack Smith? Barb, what do you think?
Yeah, this is so interesting. So there's been some concern because Jeanine Pirro in the District of Columbia has called a special grand jury. Now, in many districts, this is pretty routine. In my district, in the Eastern District of Michigan, we always had a special grand jury that was going on. The difference was that it could sit for 18 months instead of the normal 6-month duration for a grand jury. So if you had a more long-term investigation, like it was designed for organized crime, but we might use it for public corruption or national security, a case where it's unlikely that you're going to be in and out of the grand jury, and it might go on for more than a few months. It's less common in D.C. It is required in districts with a population over 4 million, and D.C. apparently does not have that population, and so therefore it is only convened on special occasions. They do their other long-term investigations, just recalling the 6-month grand juries. It came right after that referral for contempt of Dr. Fauci. And so there was some thought that maybe the two were related. I don't know that they are. I think that charge against Dr. Fauci is just going absolutely nowhere. Even with Dean Pirro, even with her willingness to please Donald Trump, I think she has shown with a reflecting pool case that she's not an idiot. And she knows that if she files something with just no basis whatsoever, it's not going to go anywhere. Now, Jack Smith, on the other hand, that could be a longer term investigation. And maybe Dr. Fauci, not for the, contempt part, but maybe some other part is a subject of that investigation, though he was granted immunity by President Biden. So I don't think we can be sure. I would ordinarily think no big deal, except for the fact that the particular assistant U.S. attorney who is assigned to lead this special grand jury is someone who is a Pirro loyalist. He worked with her in the Westchester County DA's office back when she was the Westchester County DA for, 34 years or something. He was there for 34 years and worked closely with her. And then she brought him into the D.C. U.S. attorney's office because he was this trusted advisor. So that's the part of this that worries me. But we really don't know until we see what materializes.
Can I ask a quick follow-up, Barb? Is it usual for that kind of grand jury, special grand jury, to be announced or leaked? I don't know how the reporting of it to get it. Don't these things usually happen behind the scenes? Or is that normal?
It is normal because has to be a request to the chief judge, in this case, Judge Boasberg, to authorize it because you're using court resources. And so that is public, and that's why this became known.
That's good to know.
All right, Kim, our last question comes to us from Brett in Tampa, Florida, who asks, what is the origin or legal basis for the filibuster?
Oh, that's a delightful question. So the filibuster, which is in the Senate, when you think of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, when a senator stands up and talks and keeps talking in order to make a point about something or to stop a vote on an issue. And that's what we think about it. That's called a talking filibuster. There are other non-talking ways to make a filibuster. But generally speaking, the legal basis for having the filibuster, and I think what the question really is about Rule 22, which allows the Senate by two-thirds votes to invoke a cloture on a specific question, which means to end discussion on something, to stop someone essentially from filibustering. So that's called the filibuster rule that can prevent filibusters. That was instituted in 1917, because before that, let's just say lawmakers had a tendency to be windy and people would get annoyed and think that that was wasting a lot of people's time. So the way that the filibuster worked in that movie with Jimmy Stewart really didn't happen very often. It only happened a handful of times between 1917 and the 1960s anyway. So the cloture rule was very rarely invoked. But that all changed in the 60s when civil rights litigation started being introduced in the Senate, and Southern lawmakers looked for a way to try to block it. And that is when the filibuster came roaring back in an effort to block those kinds of rules. Senators continued to be frustrated even despite that, but it was often difficult to get that two-thirds vote in order to call cloture and to stop them. So lawmakers were successful in blocking a lot of civil rights legislation over that. So that's when it really reached its heyday, and that's what we think of now. So I think this is important for people to know, because I think we hear lawmakers falsely who say, either because of ignorance of history or because they're trying to push a false narrative, that the reason that we have that filibuster rule is to encourage bipartisanship and to force people to come together and build and, you know, bring consensus building legislation. No, that's false. That's a lie. It's never been that. That has never been the reason for it. That has never been reason for Rule 22. That has nothing to do with anything. It's been used as an obstructive tool on both sides in both ways. And the lawmakers, mostly Republicans right now, but also some lawmakers, I'm looking at you, Senator Fetterman, who claim that there is some grand, bold reason that we need this rule, are lying. This rule has been made to stymie civil rights legislation. It's been used as gamesmanship by members of the Senate since its introduction. And I think it's highly anti-democratic, in my opinion, and I think it needs to go. But I'll let you make your own decision.
Well, thanks for listening to Sister Sidebar with Kimberly Atkins-Store and me, Barb McQuaid. Keep sending in more great questions for next week's show. And if you send in a voice memo, we will try to play your question during the next episode. You can follow Sister Sidebar and hashtag sisters-in-law wherever you listen. And please give us a 5-star review. It really helps others find the show. Please show some love to this week's sponsors, Delete Me and Life Pro Vibration Plates. The links are in the show notes. Please support them because they make this podcast possible. Don't forget to pick up hashtag sisters-in-law merch and other goodies at politicon.com/merch. And see you every week on Wednesdays and Saturdays for new episodes of hashtag sisters-in-law and Sisters Sidebar.
Wow, that, sorry, I just jumped because Snickers just scared me.
Easy, Snickers.
Just came around the corner and I wasn't. I wasn't expecting her to come out.
Bad enough. It's time to go. Let's go.
She really is. She's like, what is your problem, lady? Okay, let me go back and finish that question.